everybody, and welcome to Adjusted. I'm your host, Greg Hamlin, coming at you from beautiful Birmingham, Alabama, and Berkeley Industrial Comp, and excited about this rebroadcast episode with Alex Elswick. I met Alex, it must be 5 years ago, when he came and spoke to my former employer, and I heard his story, and it really inspired me, and I knew when we started the podcast that he was somebody that I would want to hear from. And the main reason for that is, obviously, those who've been in the industry know that we've had an opioid crisis, and workers' compensation has contributed to that, especially during the early aughts when medications like opioids were being handed out pretty readily to many of our injured workers. And unfortunately, some of them became victims of addiction because of the medications that were prescribed. And of course, so much has changed since then, but the damage done from it has not ended. And Alex's story is interesting. While it is not a workers' compensation story, I think it's a pretty human story that I wanted to be sure that we share with our audience again, as Alex had his wisdom teeth out, ended up getting dry sockets and getting addicted to opioids. And he's very, very candid with his discussion of how he went from a college student to being homeless to now being a professor, University of Kentucky, I believe. So I hope you enjoy this episode. Hope it resonates with you the same way it did with me. And without further ado, we'll go to the episode. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Adjusted, a claims podcast for workers' compensation enthusiasts. I'm your host, Greg Hamlin, coming at you from Sweet Home, Alabama, and Berkeley Industrial Comp. And with me for the day is my co-host, Michael Gilmartin. You want to introduce yourself, Michael? For those who don't know you, Mike.
Sure, yeah. Don't call me Michael. That's when I'm in trouble. But Mike Gilmartin. Formerly AVP of Specialty Claims at Key Risk, now Area Vice President of Sales and Distribution at Key Risk. So I'm going over to the dark side, been on one of their podcasts with Greg, and excited to be here.
I'm glad to have you, Mike. So Mike and I go back a ways. We actually started our careers with the same company. So it's funny how life can twist and turn. We have a special guest with us today, Alex Elswick. Alex is with Voices of Hope in Lexington, Kentucky, and I had the opportunity to meet Alex 3-4 years ago and hear his story. And I was so impressed with Alex's story that I really wanted to share it with you today. So Alex, can you say hey to everybody?
Yeah, thanks for having me, Greg and Mike. I didn't know that there were workers' compensation enthusiasts. I didn't know that was a whole thing.
Well, I might be making that up, but I'm believing somebody.
We're not sure there are either, bud, so just go with it.
That's exactly right. Somebody's got to be listening to this, I hope. But Well, Alex, I wanted you to first, you know, your story, I think, is pretty unique. And a lot of times when we talk to folks on workers' compensation principles, we don't get the chance to talk to people who may be on the other side. And I know your specific situation isn't a work injury, but I do think there's some crossover with what happened with your story that maybe some people could relate to. And I know when I first met you, you talked a little bit about how your struggle with addiction and how you got to where you are now. I thought it would be helpful for folks to kind of just talk through, how did you first get introduced to addictive substances, Alex?
Yeah, so it's quite a journey. I think in order to set a little context, two things that are helpful to know about me. One is that addiction runs in my family. Just a tremendous amount of addiction and mental illness in my family. And then in addition to that, I'm a person with a lot of multiple anxiety disorders. And so I think when I first encountered a drug at 14 years old, it was in that context of like a kid who's struggling with anxiety, hadn't been diagnosed yet and hadn't begun to manage it. And so I started experimenting the same way most kids do, I think, nicotine and then alcohol and then marijuana. But my addiction really started with an elective outpatient oral surgery to have my wisdom teeth removed. And I was prescribed oxycodone and took it as prescribed, but got addicted to it.
That's, you know, I think that story is where a lot of people's story begins, is, you know, the medication gets prescribed for something that's appropriate and digs its claws in and can cause a lot of heartache. So how old were you when you had your wisdom teeth out?
Yeah, I was 18 years old, and I was in my second semester at Center College. I actually was 2 weeks before our first baseball game. I was playing at baseball at center. 2 weeks before our first baseball game, I got arrested on drug-related charges, marijuana charges, and pretty big ones, pretty nasty ones. And so I had been kicked out of college about 2 months prior to when I had the surgery. And so that, I think that added context too, of just like, I lost my social circle. I lost kind of school, which was an anchor for me, and was kind of just floundering a little bit. And then you threw a prescription to opioids in there. It was kind of like just lighting a match.
So from that point, getting from prescription opioids to at that point, I'm sure there's a certain point where the doctor's not going to prescribe more. So when you're having, when you had reached the point where you're like, this is working for me with my anxiety and the other issues I have, you know, where do you go from there? How did you end up, what were the next chapters of that story?
Yeah, it's interesting kind of how that played out, because I ended up getting dry sockets in the four wounds in my mouth. So they gave me a second script for oxycodone. So I ended up in total like a 30-day supply of opioids for a really minor outpatient procedure. And today we do opioid stewardship totally different. We wouldn't prescribe that many, but we didn't know the risk at the time. So I got like a 30-day supply, and when it ran out, I didn't anticipate that there was going to be a problem when it ran out. I hadn't had any experience to that point. So I just wasn't really thinking about it. But when the prescription ran out, I got really sick, and I felt nauseous, and I felt like my anxiety really ratcheted up. I felt really irritable. And just on some level, it's kind of hard to explain, you know, without the lived experience, but on some level, like just in my body, I knew if I could get more of that medicine that I could make the bad feeling go away. And so that's really just how addiction started for me. You know, people talk about partying and getting high and addiction, and I always take issue with those phrases because they're just not accurate representations of what people experience. I wasn't getting high, and I surely wasn't partying. I was just trying to experience relief and being okay. And then couldn't stop. So
going back to the beginning of that story and having the procedure, and this is something we work on, and I think we're getting better at and more confident, hopefully medicine in general, but when you were given that script, was there any kind of conversation around how powerful medication it could be and like kind of some of the pitfalls, you know, you need to look out for when taking it? Or was it more just, here's your script, like, you know, let us know if you need more or you feel better?
Yeah, no, there was no education at all. And so again, this is 10 years ago. So things are very different now. Now, you know, we're always encouraging providers to have a conversation about risk when they prescribe an opioid, and even to also prescribe naloxone to everyone who's prescribed an opioid because it can reverse an overdose. I'll tell you one worse. A couple years later, my mom went to an oral surgeon to have another procedure done, and he was going to prescribe some sort of medicine, and she asked if it was addictive. And he laughed and he said something to the effect of, why are you afraid you're going to end up down on the corner of Winchester Road or something? And it's like this really stigmatized, really aggressive, like totally dismissing the possibility that my mom could be a person who could get addicted. Because why? Because she's a white lady, because she's middle-aged. I don't know, but she's definitely a person who could get addicted, if you know my mom, like me. So we don't want her touching any of that stuff either. So no, there was no meaningful conversation about it. And I think part of it too is a little bit of an attitude that says, like, if you get addicted, it's your own fault. Yep. Right? We don't bear responsibility for protecting you from these things. You should be able to stop using when it's time to stop using.
Well, I think it goes back to your point. Sorry, Greg. It goes back to
no, go what ahead.
You're saying, which I find interesting, because I think I have folks in my family who've had addiction issues and have gone down this path and to no fault of their own. Your point, there's so many factors. I find it interesting because I do agree with you. I think the stigma is out there and that, okay, I got these pills. I feel awesome in these pills. I just want to do more and do more, and I'm having fun with it, as opposed to my body's telling me I need more. I've become dependent on it. I just think it's such a different narrative when you realize not everybody, I mean, granted, there are people out there that do it recreationally and then it takes off, but it's just fascinating to hear you say that, because I think there is such a misnomer of, you must have done something wrong in order to become addicted to the substance, as opposed to the other way around, and that the substance caused you to become addicted.
Yeah, that's well said, that like that we believe that you have to do something wrong in order to get addicted. Because I was just 15 minutes before I got on here, I was talking to a group at Powell County students, Powell County High School, and always making this the case that like the difference between the kid who gets addicted and the kid who doesn't is not necessarily the decisions they make. And it's not a big wide difference. Their lives can look really, really similar for 17 or 18 years. And it can be something small. It can be a difference in their mental health, in their family environment, and whatever. So yeah, I mean, I think because people assign that blame, it's your fault you got addicted, then we also think it's your responsibility to get out of it. And we don't owe you any help from a public health perspective in offering assistance, you know.
I think that's really important. And Alex, I want to applaud you just even for talking about this stuff, because I think half the problem, you know, my family is same as Mike's, has had all kinds of issues with this. You know, and I watched my nephew pass away at 18 from an overdose. And this stuff, people don't talk about it enough because it's a little bit embarrassing, I think. And because it's not talked about, then it's not normalized. And then people don't get the help they need. Because it's sort of this dark secret that's sitting out there. So I know what you're doing takes a lot of courage, and really applaud you for not only talking to us today, but talking to kids at schools and getting your voice out there to anybody who can hear it, because I think it's a really important message. So when you reach the point where you couldn't get the medication from the dentist anymore, I'm assuming at that point that led you to the street, or what was the next step that got you to the point where you're like, I'm taking this next step? Because I think I've heard people say, well, I could never imagine myself using illegal opioids, like street drugs. I could never see myself doing that. And I think that's probably where most people's stories start, is never envisioning that. So I wanted you to talk more about that part.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting point, because there is something of a transition that happens when you go from having a prescription to buying on the street. I guess for me, I guess let me have you rephrase the question. Can you ask it again? I lost my
Sure. Time. So I'm just wondering, like, when you go from I was on a prescription, now I can't get the prescription and I have to find the opioid somewhere else, otherwise I'm going to feel terrible. Like, how does that process happen, and what's that like?
Yeah. So I'll take a step back for just a second. We like to talk about marijuana as the gateway drug, and it's really misleading, because overwhelmingly, nicotine is the gateway drug. It's the first substance people take that acts on the reward system. But marijuana, it is a gateway drug in the sense that it's your first introduction to illicit markets. Mm-hmm. Because if you're using nicotine or alcohol, you go to the store, you ask an older adult to buy it. This is your first time going to an illicit market. And so if you're well-versed in that, because you've been a regular marijuana user, going to the street to buy any other substance really isn't as big of a leap as you think. And so we don't normally think of it in those terms, but I really think that's the answer. It was because I had some experience with marijuana and with, you know, we're not talking about like dope dealers in the projects. We're just talking
right.
About white kids with collared shirts selling pot, but still you have access to these markets. And what that means then is when you have a taste and appetite for something else, like an opioid, you know, your trade routes are laid down already, so to speak. So it's really easy to go get them. And as it happens, opioids were being diverted to the street in like massive numbers around that time. It just wasn't hard to find. We hadn't started the big DEA crackdowns on pill mills and stuff like that. So it really, if you knew where to look, it wasn't hard to find. And then I was getting access to stronger and stronger opioids on the street, which of course makes the problem get worse and worse.
Interesting. You know, you said you come from a strong family of addictive personalities, and you know that you have an addictive personality, and there's a lot more that goes into addiction than just, hey, I tried a drug and I liked it. Did you have any inclination before you go to have the surgery and you get the opioids, when you were smoking weed or drinking, whatever you're doing, were you like, man, I like this a little too much? Like, did you have that frame of mind at all? Or was it kind of just like, I had no clue, and then all of a sudden, here's where I am?
Yeah, it's a good question, but I mean, I do everything excessively. It is who I am. So there is, you know, some credence to the idea of just a personality. I do everything just all or nothing. It's just the way I'm made. It's kind of a character flaw. But so definitely I was doing that with marijuana right before opioids entered the picture. So, you know, it's not uncommon for a college student to smoke pot. We all know that. But it is uncommon for anyone to smoke weed all the live long day, and to smoke before practice and before exams and before you're studying and before you're going to see your family and before you're doing everything. Marijuana is a fixture. And so I think on some level, I knew that that wasn't normal, but that's not the same thing as recognizing it as a problem. You know what I mean? I guess I kind of had an ego about it and sort of thought like, look at me, I can party all day and make the grades and make the team and do kind of what I want to do. And it caught up with me, you know.
So when did you feel, like I've hit rock bottom, I need to change?
Yeah, it took a little while to get there. So I got back into school. Center College let me back in, restored my scholarships after I got kicked out and got arrested on campus. And then I left two more times to go to rehab while I was at Center, and then left Center and just went through a period of my life where I probably went to treatment 7 times in 18 months or something. It was really miserable, really hard time in my life. And I would go to treatment and do well, and I would start to get better. My, you know, brain and body would start to heal. And then I would get out and I would come back to Lexington and I would relapse right away. And then I'd go to treatment for longer. And then I would get out and I would relapse, and over again. And the whole time people are saying, you know, if you really want to stop, you'll just stop. And they're communicating that in different ways. You know, we have a good family friend who I love dearly and has always been really supportive of me, but she physically pushed me onto a couch and said, "What's the matter with you? Why won't you stop? Don't you see what you're doing to your family?" And it's like, I know it sounds so small and insignificant, but it's like scarred me. And I'll never forget that feeling of just like, everybody's mad at me and I can't make it stop. And I'm mad too, you know, and I'm not allowed to be mad. What I have to do is I have to just eat all the shame. And it just didn't seem right. In any event, I remember becoming resigned to the fact that like, I'll just be addicted the rest of my life. I was sitting in the Kroger parking lot on Richmond Road after another relapse. And I just thought, you know, I don't want to do this again. Treatment's miserable and it's not doing anything for me. And so I moved to Cincinnati with a girl I was dating and got introduced to heroin and using a needle, and things went kind of from bad to worse. And I ended up, you know, when I used to tell people about my addiction, I used to give people this laundry list of all these horrible things I did because I thought it's what I was supposed to do. And I've learned that it kind of only perpetuates more stigma. So I don't generally do that, but I share one with you. I bought my girlfriend this really nice Tiffany's bracelet and woke up one morning in August of 2012, just sick as a dog withdrawing from heroin. And she went to work and I snuck into her room and I took it to a pawn shop and I got probably $80 for a $400 bracelet and spent it on heroin, you know, and she kicked me out. And so I went homeless, and just to keep a long story short, I ended up spending time homeless in Nashville, Tennessee, in Lexington, Kentucky, in Cincinnati, and Dayton, Ohio. And I spent the very end of addiction sleeping under a bridge in Dayton. So that's pretty well my rock bottom there, sleeping under a bridge, you know, pretty much a stereotype. It's like a, you know, it's a Red Hot Chili Peppers song, right? Under the bridge. But there's a reason that that's where addiction takes you, I guess.
That's a tough story. And I appreciate you sharing that. So what led from that moment then to the recovery point you're at now, which I think, you know, you're doing so much. So I'm curious, like, what changed this time that was different for you going forward than the other times?
Yeah, such a good question and such a funny answer, because the treatment center that I ended up starting my recovery in was a Salvation Army, which is a homeless shelter in Dayton. And they technically have what they call an adult rehabilitation center, but they have very little funding. They don't use evidence-based practices. It's mostly just a place you lay your head at night, you get hot meals, you get some compassionate care. All the places I went to before that were really nice treatment centers that use evidence-based practices, and they're credentialed and they have all these clinicians. And I relapsed every time I left. And so that's not a knock on treatment in particular, but it's a knock on the way that we think about treating. So addiction is this, causes these long-term changes in your brain. It's this chronic disorder. And yet we keep trying to treat it in little 30-day bits. And it just doesn't work that way, because these changes, we can see in brain scans, they last 2 or 3 years. And so the critical difference wasn't necessarily the treatment so much as what I transitioned into. So the last time, instead of transitioning back home and going around the same people, and I went somewhere different. I ended up, there's a church in Lexington that let me sleep at the parsonage for free in exchange for doing labor. I wasn't a particularly a churchgoer, but that's when the community showing up for you, you know? And so I had a place to live, and then a guy offered me a job, not a job that I deserved, not a job that I earned by merit or because I had some illustrious, you know, resume, but just because somebody said, hey, you know, you deserve a chance. And then when I had a job, I had health insurance. And then when I had health insurance, I could see a therapist. Then when I could see a therapist, I could address my anxiety. And it's like, oh man, when your needs are met, you get better. You know, it's a simple, but not easy.
So it sounds like just part of that story that I've heard you kind of mentioned a few times is there's some frustration in how the general system's even built out to help people who are struggling with this stuff.
Yeah, I know this podcast is time limited, so we probably better not get lost entirely because I get up on a soapbox. But yeah, there's the quickest way to say it is so much of the way that we address addiction in this country belies the evidence. We have all this scientific evidence that doesn't match the way that we address it. And what you get inevitably are really high rates of addiction and relapse and overdose, you know?
So I want to go back and ask a question about something you brought up, which I find interesting, because I don't know that I've ever thought of it this way in terms of the story of a close family friend throwing the couch saying, why are you doing this, you know, to your family? And I think you made an interesting point that, like, I'm mad at myself, right? Like, I can't even worry about anybody else. I'm pissed at myself for doing this over and over again. And so I guess my question is twofold. Kind of, do you agree that, like, it's really solely up to the person to decide when they're ready to seek help and truly want to change? And then two, how can people around you be better in those situations, if those questions make sense?
Yeah, those are also great quintessential questions. And if you ask somebody else the first question, you're going to get a different answer, because a lot of people who have lived experience who come from the recovery community will say, you got to want it yourself. You got to get it. You got to do the work, all that kind of stuff. That is not what matches the evidence. And I'm a scientist today, so that's my job, is to look at the evidence. And what the evidence says, as I indicated earlier, people get better when their needs are met. So when we say, you know, do you have to want it? Well, what is it that they have to want? Do they have to want to be abstinent? Because everybody wants to be healthier and everybody wants to be happier. In all my work, I've never encountered anybody who said, I don't want to be better. I don't want to be happier, right? And so we have this idea in this country that the only outcome we should be pursuing for people in addiction is abstinence. And as long as you can pass a drug test, then we've done something good. You might be miserable and your housing situation might be shoddy and your relationships might be embroiled in conflict, but we don't really care as long as that drug test comes up negative. And there's a totally different approach that's taken in most other countries across, or many other countries across the globe. It's like, hey, let's reduce the harm. Let's focus on limiting the overdose and the disease transmission and the homelessness and all the fallout. And we don't care so much about what you do or don't put in your body, you know? So different approach, but I definitely believe, you know, you essentially do get out of it what you put into it. So it does require effort, but that doesn't mean that the person who says, I don't want to be sober, that we cast them out of society, or that we should be comfortable with the fact that they're sleeping under a bridge. That to me is like indicative of something's wrong with our society, that we're okay with that for anybody. So then, to kind of answer your second question, it's really hard when you're a family member or a loved one and somebody you care about is going through it, because here's a helpful way to think about it. So when you get addicted, what's happened is it's your survival circuitry in your brain that's been hijacked. So the part of your brain that wants to get food, water, sex, bonding. So essentially your brain comes to believe on a deep level, deep in your brain, that this pill or this powder is actually essential to my survival. Not just that I like it, but I need it to survive to see another day, right? So if I have family and friends who are trying to come to me to say, hey, we got to get you into treatment, on some deep level, I perceive that as a threat to my survival, because you're trying to come between me and the thing that's going to sustain me. And so then when you think about the lying and the deceit from people who become addicted in that view, when you take that perspective, it's not as moralistic. It's not as like they're bad people and they're always lying about their drug use. It's like, hey, this is a suffering person and they're trying to protect their ability to experience relief. And you, even as a good meaning family member, probably stand in the way of that a little bit. And then just one, I know I'm just kind of rambling, but one more thing
great.
That is just shame. What you said, the fact that anyone in this society still believes that we need to punish addiction out of people is wild, because there's a great, addiction physician, Keith Humphreys, who says, punishing addiction out of people doesn't work. If it worked, everyone would get sober on their own because addiction is the most punishing experience there is. And it's absolutely true. There, you know, people said lots of awful things to me. I had a police officer curse me out when I was flying a sign in Dayton. And like, I had lots of bad experiences, people saying bad things, but nothing that anybody said could hold a light to the things that I'm thinking and feeling about myself. I was at Center College. I was going to go to law school. I had dreams and I had ambitions. And now I'm like at a shelter, you know, I don't need to be kicked when I'm at the shelter, I guess. That's what I would say.
So I guess, you know, take that a step further. What is the right? Because it's hard. I agree. And as a family member who's seen it, it is hard to sit back and know that in your head, whether you know it or not, and you realize it. It's very hard to say, I really have no power over this. And what is the suggestion, right? So you're watching somebody you love go down this road, or maybe it's early on that road. How can people better help those around them, I guess, is what I'm trying to say in a roundabout way.
Well, it's an important question. So the first thing I would say is I don't know if I learned this in sports or recovery, but it applies both places and it's brilliant. You got to connect before you correct. In other words, you know, when you're working with your kids, when you're coaching, when you're doing anything, you can't just come in and start telling people what to do and criticizing them if you haven't built a rapport. And so when I'm talking to family members in that sense, what I'm saying is you really have to protect the relationship always. That's really, really important because, like I said, they're in a place of shame. They're in a place of trying to protect their ability to survive. And so what they need right there is really some compassion. So that's step one. And then beyond that, there are a lot of things that family members can do. So I always commend to family members to get their own kind of support. So there are like Al-Anon is a companion program to Alcoholics Anonymous. So it's for family members who kind of learn about dealing with that powerlessness over their loved one's addiction. That can be a helpful place. There's also a training called CRAFT. It stands for Community Reinforcement and Family Training. And it is more effective than Al-Anon and some other strategies at getting family members into treatment. So it's actually an intervention that's specifically designed to help encourage your family member into treatment when they struggle. So those options are available too. But for the most part, what I tell family members is we have to keep people alive. You know, we have to, the only way you have a shot at recovery is if we keep you alive. So the most important thing I'm focusing on with the folks I work with is harm reduction. How do we make sure that you have naloxone on hand at all times, that you're never using alone, that we just mitigate the risk long enough until you're in the place where you're willing and able and ready to make a change.
I think that's great. I love what you said about connecting and the importance of that. Like I mentioned before, I've got five kids of my own, and I know that when you want to correct, if the relationship's not there, it's going to be a tough ride. Yeah. It's going to be a tough ride. So for you, when you're thinking about recovery, what does that mean to you, and what are the things that you do to stay in recovery?
Yeah, great question. So if you look at SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration, they have a working definition of recovery. And it's kind of interesting if you look at it. So it says it's something like a process of change through which individuals improve their health and wellness, live a self-directed life, and strive to reach their own potential, their full potential. So you think about that definition, that's pretty broad. That's a big umbrella.
And say, that sounds like a good mission for a lot of people, anybody really, right?
Like be healthier, right?
Right.
Have autonomy, be able to make your own decisions for yourself, be healthier, and be the best you can be. That's pretty, there's no mention of abstinence. There's no mention of drugs because that doesn't define recovery. That's not how we determine whether or not a person's in recovery. So for me, recovery is extraordinarily individualistic. And there are people who don't want their recovery to look like abstinence. I know lots of people who were addicted to heroin, had nasty, nasty heroin addictions like mine. And today they drink alcohol, and they drink alcohol with no problem. And that's fine if that works for them. I support that. We're not going to judge that. We're not going to shame that. We're not going to try to pathologize that and say you're headed down a bad path, because that's not necessarily what the data show. We're going to let this person live their recovery. And that really comes to bear then with things like medication. So we know that the gold standard actually for treating opiate addiction is medication like Suboxone, which is buprenorphine, or methadone, things like that. But if you believe that recovery equals abstinence, then you believe people taking medication aren't in recovery and you believe they're cheating or they have a crutch. And there's a tremendous stigma among people in recovery surrounding medication to the extent that people on Suboxone don't want to go to AA meetings, for instance, because they don't want to have to say that they're using a substance. So yeah, for me, recovery is really broad and roomy and it's about what you want it to be. So like at Voices of Hope, when our recovery coaches sit down with someone, they don't say, hey, here's our treatment plan or here's what we're going to do. It literally starts with, how can I help you with your recovery today? What do you want?
And is there, I feel like we hear it all the time. And again, I just like Greg, I applaud you for sharing the story. I think it's unbelievable what you do on a daily basis. But I feel like there's a lot of, I don't know, maybe this isn't a misnomer. Now I'm rambling, but people say like, you get up every day when you're recovering, you make a choice to recover every single day. Is that accurate? Is that something you... Like, does that come into your mind at all? Is that a real thing?
You know what? It's cool. For me, it doesn't anymore. It did for a long time. But in the original Alcoholics Anonymous text, the two co-founders had two very different experiences with their recovery. So Bill Wilson had a sort of like white light spiritual experience, and it just took away his desire to drink. Boom, done. Don't have to deal with it anymore. Dr. Bob, the other guy, had this really painstaking, slow, like have to give it up, have to make the choice every day, grind it out. And I like thinking about that because I think they're kind of different poles on the same spectrum. But in the beginning, it took physical, conscious effort not to use drugs, which is a crazy thing to say, because imagine you guys wake up and do a pretty good job not using drugs most of the time. You don't have to put a lot of thought into it, right?
Right.
And it's wild, but I had to be really thoughtful about where I was going to go and who I was going to see and how structured my day would be. And I haven't thought like that in quite a while. I just got to a point where I actually got to a point where I didn't want to count the days anymore, to be honest with you. Where I just didn't want to have to be on a timer and ticking. And I just wanted to be, I just wanted to do my thing, you know?
No, I think that's great. I think, so in terms of people around you and supporting you, and I know one of the questions you have are kind of what helps you stay in recovery and how can you work with people? It's interesting you say a ticking, like, you know, not time bomb, but do you find, or did you find at least throughout your recovery, your family was kind of like pins and needles of like, when's it going to happen again? Or, oh my God, where is he going? Or why is he hanging out with those people? I feel like that's going to be a really hard part of recovery, is almost the expectations of everyone around you. And that thought of like, what are they going to do next? Or is tomorrow the day? Did that affect you? Or does that affect you?
Definitely. And it's so often overlooked. That's really keen, because it's like, you're already dealing with all the suffering of your addiction, whatever mental health problems you're having, the fallout from your financial decisions and your financial ruin, and you don't have a home, and just your life is just crap, right? And then on top of that, you've just got the concern of everyone. You're being monitored and scrutinized and surveilled. And it's like, have you been to a meeting today? Where are you going? All that kind of stuff. And so it was really problematic when in the beginning, when I would go to treatment and get out and I kept relapsing, I kept coming back to my parents' house and I was spending most of my time in my mom's basement. And even though you would think, hey, this is a drug-free, healthy, supportive environment, it just wasn't. And, it, you know, you can talk to her today and she understands it. She was, and I'm not blaming her, right? It was just the way that she was reacting to the stress of her kid being homeless and shooting dope and whatever else. So she's very anxious. She's very neurotic about it. And that's getting projected, you know? And she didn't mean to do it. Obviously, she wants to be as supportive as she can. But so then the last time when I left the Salvation Army, I didn't go back to my parents' house. It was the first time I moved out on my own. And I moved into an environment that I think a lot of people would have said might not look as good for my recovery. You know, I don't have maybe as much support as I would at home. But it was in reality, it was a much better environment. And it also forced me to grow up in some ways, too. But that's just a good example of what I mean by really individual recovery. There are some people who are going to be better off going back to their parents' house because that's where they have all the support they need. For me, wasn't the best. And yet, even saying that, I have had tremendous, tremendous support from my family. And that's like tremendous, meaningful support, especially from my mom. I just didn't need to be living with her.
Those relationships can be really tough. You know, I have fantastic parents, but I remember even when I was in college, when I'd go home at a certain point, you're like, you know what? Like, I'm not your 16-year-old son anymore. You know, so, and I love my mom, but it's just a different relationship, right? When you're an adult. So I could definitely see that.
And developmentally, you know, I'm 21, 22 years old. I should be out on my own. I feel like I'm should be grown and on my own because I should, but I wasn't capable because of the addiction. So you're really in a tight spot there where you feel like you're being infantilized, treated like a child, and you are because, hey, you really can't take care of yourself like an adult yet. So what do we do with you?
Yeah, that is really difficult. Well, one question I had, Alex, and I don't know if there's been any impact, but I know the whole world's turned upside down over the last year with COVID. And I'm just curious from your perspective, if you'd seen any impact. I know you work with a lot of people who are in the recovery community. Has there been any impact to that or not so much?
Yeah, tremendous impact. So the calendar year that went like May 2020 to March 2020 to March 2021, we had more overdoses than in any 12-month period in history. So we set the record. It was like 88,000 overdoses per CDC. So, you know, we already had an opioid epidemic, and then we had a public health pandemic fall on top of it. And it meant it was a lot harder for people to access treatment, access a variety of different services. Syringe exchanges got shut down. So yeah, just a tremendous impact. And even within our kind of family at Voices of Hope, we've had multiple folks who have taken their lives and multiple folks who have overdosed during this time. So it's definitely hit close to home. And it's, you know, and then the other thing is the fact that people couldn't go to meetings, which is a big one. It's the fact that people could, you know, that social interactions like organic medicine when you're in recovery and you just couldn't get around people. And so it meant a lot more isolating and addiction kind of flourishes in that context.
So are we, I guess it's probably way too early to tell. Is it starting to get back to normal in terms of people being able to access meetings and care and everything, or is it still fairly shut down? Because it's interesting you say that, because I think everybody on some level, whether you have an addiction or have had any issues or not, felt isolated during the pandemic. And I think I can't even imagine what that looks like when you rely on communities to understand you're not alone and that you know other people are going through the same thing as you. Are we seeing an improvement, or is it still pretty shut down?
Yeah, definitely an improvement. One of the silver lining, I guess, of COVID's impact is that since it forced all these meetings to go online to Zoom, I think it's actually brought some new people into the fold. Some folks who maybe just weren't comfortable going to those meetings, physically having to take their body into those spaces. And so we've had a couple of unique kinds of meetings that are really flourishing, I think, because they're online, which is pretty cool. But things are going back to normal. But unfortunately, what normal was almost a record year of overdoses, right? That's what mm-hmm. that context right before the pandemic. So yeah, it's just really, really bad, really bad. And yeah, we do a poor job of handling it in general.
So Alex, I wanted you to talk a little bit about what you're doing with Voices of Hope. I know that's where you work now. And I know you're really, I think of you as a hero or a crusader for trying to make change in not only individuals' lives, but your community and the system as a whole. Talk to us a little bit about what you're doing there and what your employer's mission is.
Yeah, very cool. So first of all, I guess I should say this. Voices of Hope is not actually my employer. I work at UK. I'm a professor at University of Kentucky. Voices doesn't pay me. They should. They should pay me lots and lots of money. I never get a dime.
When you get on famous podcasts with workers' comp,
that's right.
Audiences, you're golden, man. You'll be good.
That's right. That's right.
As long as I get to interact with workers' comp business.
You're on your way.
That's right.
So Voices of Hope, the reality is I'm really privileged, right? I grew up in the suburbs. I went to private schools. I had the best educational opportunities. And it's not a brag and it's not something I'm ashamed of. It's just the reality. It's the way I grew up. And it made a big difference when it came time for my recovery, because I had the things that I needed. I had the housing, I had, right, all the ingredients that a lot of people don't have. I left the Salvation Army with some guys who had to go back to another homeless shelter when they left. So they're spending the beginning of their recovery in a shelter, right? And so when we started Voices of Hope, we said, we want this to be something that levels the playing field, that replicates that really good experience that I got. We want other people to be able to have that experience, to have that kind of support, that those kind of opportunities. And so what we created is called a recovery community organization. And there are a few like it across the country, but we're not a treatment center. So we don't have clinicians. People don't come and stay with us for treatment. All of our 30 staff are people in recovery with lived experience from their own addictions. So we're people in recovery, helping people in recovery. And we host lots of different kinds of meetings every week to support different pathways to recovery. So if your recovery looks like abstinence, we've got lots of meetings for you. If you use medication, we've got meetings for you. If you use something as a part of your recovery, we've got meetings for you. If you're religious, we've got something for you. If you're secular, you know, all that. And then one of the most important things we do is recovery coaching, which is our recovery coaches have lived experience in addiction. They're from this part of the state. They're familiar with the resources and the linkages that people need. And they sit down with somebody and say, how can I help you with your recovery today? What's the barrier that you're facing today that you need? And the services are always free, which is probably the best part. And so, you know, we're kind of like the community hub for all things recovery.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, I was going to ask a question based off of that. My wife works in public health and does a lot of things around this topic. But are there a lot of other groups that do the kind of the targeted meetings like that? I mean, you went back to, you know, not one way is the right way. Everybody does it differently. But you find, at least as an outsider, the narrative generally is you should never do it again. All the meetings are centered around that. And that's kind of it. Are you guys on the forefront of that? Or are there a lot of groups doing that and recognizing you need different outlets for people depending on where they are?
Mike, if we were in person, I would lay a big smooch right on your cheek right now. That was such a good question. And the way that you phrased that, like you use the term narrative. And I just wrote a paper that we're trying to get published right now that is called The Single Story Narrative of Addiction and Recovery. And the whole point of this paper is basically that we keep telling this story that everyone who gets addicted needs to hit rock bottom. They need to go to treatment and they need to be abstinent. And everybody believes that that's how everybody gets better. And then you look at the evidence and it's not even close, not even close. So this idea of multiple pathways is really not about doing something crazy or unique for people who are on the fringes of recovery. It's actually about the majority of people in recovery, because as it turns out, it's actually a minority of people who take a pure abstinence-based approach. So really providing spaces for all pathways becomes extremely important. And the more that we lean into that work, the more you understand why, the more you see reasons why. And, you know, maybe you experience your recovery differently as a Black person in recovery, or maybe you experience it differently if you're on the LGBTQ spectrum, or all those kinds of things. So it's just like, hey, everybody's is a little different and their advantages are going to be a little different. Their barriers are going to be a little different. So it's just kind of about meeting those needs. In general, no, there's very little offered outside of a very narrow abstinence-based approach. And so it's problematic. So for instance, I told you all that people on medication experience stigma sometimes in 12-step meetings because people say, hey, you're taking something, you're not really sober. Drug court programs, specialty court programs, oftentimes people, even people on medication, are court ordered to go to 12-step meetings for support. Mm. So you're supposed to be going there to be supported. And instead, every time you walk in there, you feel like crap and you feel like you're doing something wrong. I mean, it's a nightmare situation. And it, again, just speaks to the need for, let's have stuff that fits for everybody, meets all the needs.
I think that's fantastic. And I'm glad that you're out there getting your voice out there with that. Now, you mentioned UK and that you're working for the university. What talk a little to us a little bit about what you're doing there.
Yeah, so I'm an assistant professor at UK for substance use prevention and recovery. So I tell people I'm the drug guy and I do drugs all day and then do drug stuff all day. But
is that how you get people to come to class, man?
Exactly. I'll tell you how I get them to come to class. It's the coolest freaking class. Because what's more exciting when you're 19 years old than talking about pot or something? You know what I mean? Coming to class, we debate legalization versus decriminalization versus prohibition, and we talk about drug policy and we do drug history, and it's a blast. So yes.
That's awesome. Well, I'm a criminal justice major from Indiana University, and we studied a lot of those same principles, and I love that stuff. So glad that you're out there doing that. So just to kind of wrap things up, Alex, what piece of advice would you give somebody who's struggling with addiction that might be listening today? Likely somebody's hearing this and maybe your story connected with them.
Yeah, I would say you've got to find a person. You need one person who you can trust, who you don't feel is judging you, who you don't feel is trying to force you into anything. You need to find somebody who's a genuine support. And I found that in a therapist, believe it or not. I had a therapist who I thought I had worked with him previously, and I thought he was going to shame me for all my drug use. And he had a totally different approach, and it helped it because he connected with me first. Then he was able to correct me, right? Because we had that relationship, I let him in and made a difference. So I think that's the biggest thing. You know, people recover all sorts of different ways. And so the best way to recover is the way that you do it. But the way that you get started, the way that I got started was by finding somebody I could trust, that I could start to talk those things out with and just explore what it would be like to give it up or give it up a little bit, you know?
Well, thank you, Alex. I really appreciate you taking the time to visit with us today. If anybody wants to get in touch with you, Alex, what's the best way for them to do that? Do you have an email or that we could share?
Yes, alex@voicesofhopelex.org, all one word, voicesofhopelex.org. You can check us out, voicesofhopelex.org, and on Facebook, social media, that kind of stuff, all kinds of cool stuff on there. Check
us out. Thanks, Alex. Well, that's it for today. We hope you'll join us for future podcasts releasing every 2 weeks. And if you can't get enough Adjusted in your life, then check out the Adjusted blog from our resident blogger, Natalie Dangles. And that drops on the opposite Monday of the podcast. And it can be found at www.burkandcomp.com. And if you liked your listen, please give us a review on Apple's podcast platform. We wanted to express special thanks to Cameron Runyon for our excellent music. If you need more music in your life, please contact him directly by locating his email in our show notes. And thanks again for all your support. And remember, do right, think differently, and don't forget to care. That's it, guys. Thanks.